Scotch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new film Shazam, Pet Sematary, The Best of Enemies, The Aftermath, and the new Twilight Zone reboot. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring The Mortal Engines. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
First piece of news I want to hit is about Mark Hamill. He is apparently going to be the voice of Chucky in the remake of Child's Play, which I think is a great choice. I mean, Brad Dourif was fantastic, and I loved Brad Dourif in the original Child's Play. And what's funny is Brad Dourif himself isn't a huge horror fan. I mean, he's played some pretty bizarre characters, everything from, you know, the voice behind Chucky to Peter DeVries in David Lynch's Dune. It just kind of became his thing. And it reminds me of a certain way, of the way Freddy Krueger was always played by Robert Englund, and Robert Englund just dove into it. And throughout the years, even though Englund made Freddy Krueger his own, he did get a little cheesy as he got more and more into the character, and as he got more and more of a legacy because of it, he got cheesier and cheesier as it went on. And I feel that that happened a little bit with Chucky. With the new Chucky movies, like The Curse of Chucky and The Cult of Chucky, it's moved into the direct-to-video. And while those are great, and also having Fiona Dourif as well, you know, Brad Dourif's daughter in there, I think it's neat. It is kind of interesting to see what they'll do when they breathe new life into it and how it affects the movies that are going direct-to-video. But I think Mark Hamill's a fantastic voice actor, and he really came to his own in the 90s and into 2000s. I mean, he's best known for being the voice of the Joker, and I think he gave himself a great resurgence and sort of embraced geek culture, which made him so vibrant when he comes back and gets involved in the Star Wars movies again. You know, he's an older guy. He's clinging to what still makes him do well as an actor, and I think that's great. So him bringing on another iconic role, I think, is fantastic. So I am looking forward to that. The next piece of news I want to hit is just something controversial that came out last week or the week before. I can't remember when this statement was made, but Jordan Peele, of course, the director of Get Out and Us, came out and said something to the effect of he would never make a movie that stars a white guy. And his response was, he's like, I've seen that movie. And of course, there's a bunch of people like, oh, he's what a racist to say this. Well, there is a certain truth to that. The black lead, male or female, in a horror movie is underrepresented. I mean, there are black horror movies, but usually when you have a lead in a horror movie, if it's a black guy, it's usually something like Tales from the Hood or Blackula or something that is targeted towards the black audience, as opposed to just a mainstream movie that stars a black lead. I have to say, that's not an overly inappropriate thing for Jordan Peele to say. I think to say that white men are more represented in horror movies than white women, in general, the most common horror movie lead in at least modern, going all the way back to at least the 80s, women have been the lead. You know, that's where the slasher genre picks up. You know, Jamie Lee Curtis started that out, and all the final girls. There's no final guy cliche in a horror movie, so I mean, maybe it's just more appropriate that, you know, you don't want a white girl as the lead of the horror movie, because we've got that. Even going back to Psycho, you had, of course you had Norman Bates, played by Anthony Perkins, but you had Janet Leigh was the lead, at least the first part of it, and then you had Vera Miles as the lead. I mean, John Gavin was a side character, and of course the bad guy being Norman Bates. I think it's great that Jordan Peele is having this surge in his career. And as long as you still keep making good horror movies, I don't care what color the actor is who's playing the role. I just want to see good horror movies. That's why I liked Us. That's why I liked Get Out. I'd like to see more of these. And I liked them in particular. One of the reasons I liked Us was because it wasn't about being black necessarily. It was just a black family. They're the ones who happened to be in the focus of the movie, it wasn't about the black condition necessarily, whereas, of course, Get Out was much more obviously overtoned in the racial, specifically the racial divide. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. First one I want to talk about is the new Jim Jarmusch movie, The Dead Don't Die, which opens on June 14th.
This is really awful. Maybe the worst thing I've ever seen.
What was it, wild animals?
So what are you thinking?
I'm thinking zombies.
What?
You know, the undead. Ghouls.
You look gorgeous.
Flesh-eating zombies.
Don't joke. It's really, really creepy.
Oh, man. This isn't going to end well.
I have to admit, I had heard that Jim Jarmusch was making a zombie movie. And I did kind of roll my eyes because, I mean, I like some of Jim Jarmusch's fan. I'm not a good film nerd from the 90s. I think some of his stuff's good. I thought Dead Man was interesting. I thought Ghost Dog, The Way of the Samurai was interesting. Never was a big fan of Stranger Than Paradise, which was sort of what really put him on the map. And there's a bunch of his stuff I haven't seen. But I remember he made the vampire movie Only Lovers Left Alive a couple years ago. And that one was okay, but it was just, I mean, it was a drippy art house movie, and I didn't particularly, I just thought it dragged. I didn't think it was a great film. And I was fully expecting him to do that treatment to the zombie genre, but this looks like it's going to be one of those zom-coms, and I'm like, this actually looks kind of cute, kind of interesting, kind of fun, if for no other reason than just the dry humor that's coming out of it. Then I watched the trailer, and I was like, oh, this one looks like it's going to be a comedy. I might enjoy that one. Because I've generally found that the zombie movies I like the most are the ones that have their foot at least partly into comedy. Shaun of the Dead, Fido, that kind of stuff. So I guess I am looking forward to The Dead Don't Die. We'll see what happens this summer. The next one I want to talk about really quickly is Joker, which opens on October 4th.
Gotham has lost its way. What kind of coward would do something that cold-blooded? Someone who hides behind a mask.
I used to think that my life was a tragedy. But now I realize it's a comedy.
There are a whole bunch of movies that got footage shown at CinemaCon this week. Everything from It Chapter 2 up to, of course, Joker and Birds of Prey. Now, Joker, it looks like it's going to be a fine movie. I'm okay with the movie in concept. What I am getting annoyed about, and DC does this a lot, especially with their TV stuff, going all the way back to Smallville, is this sort of bait and switch of like, we're going to do a Superman series, but we're not going to have Superman in it. He's going to be learning to be Superman. And that's the way, that's why I never started watching Gotham, because it was like, well, we're going to do a movie about Batman and where he lives, but it's not going to be about Batman. I'm like, oh my God, they have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of published comic books out there that have thousands of stories in them. You're not at a lack of story or a lack of material. Why do you have to find some weird angle? Just do a good Batman movie. And the other thing that bothers me about this Joker movie is there was something cool about the Joker as this mysterious, nobody knew who he was, permanently painted face guy in the comics. And it looks like they're just sort of retreading Heath Ledger's Joker and giving him his history. Do we really want a history of the Joker? Isn't the Joker more terrifying if you don't know anything about him? Isn't that kind of part of what made the Heath Ledger Joker in The Dark Knight so compelling? Because you didn't know his history. He was an enigma. He came out of nowhere. And that's kind of the way he was in a lot of the comic books. But how does somebody become the Joker? And then I'm just like, oh, maybe we're digging a little bit too deep into this. I don't know. We'll see. It might be a good movie, but let's keep some mystery in our archetypes. That's all I'm asking for. Anyways, that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Best of Enemies and The Aftermath. Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews with The Best of Enemies. In Durham, North Carolina in 1971, civil rights activist Ann Atwater must work with the KKK leader C.P. Ellis to decide if schools should be integrated.
Last night, an electrical fire destroyed East End Elementary School.
Mama, where are we gonna go to school now? Mississippi putting it down.
I'm the hottest round. We gonna beat school segregation once and for all.
I'm holding a committee meeting. The council will vote to either adopt or reject school integration. I need two co-chairs, you and Ann Atwater.
Ann Atwater. I'm the president of the Klan.
He's about to hand you the keys to school integration, and you're gonna lock the door.
This is a movie that's already getting some backlash by critical press, and I'm going to call it the Green Book backlash. This is a typical movie about racism that says you just have to be nice to the racists. But you know what? Unfortunately, part of overcoming racism is changing people's minds. And being belligerent and fighting people does not change people's mind. Now, you can use the power of the courts and you can use the power of public opinion to change people's mind. But the only way you're going to get past racism is to get to know people. And sometimes, as pioneered by Martin Luther King, sometimes the best way to do that is being the bigger person. But sometimes you have to do that. I mean, if you look at Martin Luther King's approach to civil rights, he's like, go peacefully sit at the counter that you're not allowed to, and you're going to get beaten up, and you're going to get yelled at. But be the bigger person. If one side is in wrongly thinking and ignorantly thinking that you're just subhuman and an animal, acting like an animal and yelling and screaming and being violent isn't going to help your cause at all. And that sucks. And that's unfortunately what you have to do. Same thing with Green Book. A lot of people were complaining about Green Book because they're like, oh, well, Green Book is just a movie about, oh, isn't it tough? This guy had to overcome his racism. Well, yeah, that's what it's about. It's about a guy overcoming his own personal racism. That's what you have to do. That is how racism is overcome. Yeah, there's court battles and legal battles. And yeah, you're going to have times where people butt heads. But the best weapon against ignorance is education. That is what works. Because that is lasting. And it's not going to take the first time, and it's not going to take on everybody. But that's how you change people's mind. You want to change society, you got to change the hearts and minds. So that's what this movie's about. And I know there's a lot of people, because it's about C.P. Ellis, and it's his story about how he comes to accept that black people are in fact human beings. And that's a hard thing to start with, but it's an important thing to get to. Because back down in the South, and this wasn't even deep South. This was North Carolina. This, I mean, you're not talking about deep, deep Southern. This is, you know, pretty close to the Mason-Dixon line. And you still had the segregation in 1971, less than 50 years ago. I mean, I was born in 1971, and I always find this fascinating. I felt the same way about On the Basis of Sex, that Ruth Bader Ginsburg movie that came out at Christmas. I was like, these court things were going on in the 70s. I was alive during this, and I didn't realize that there were these sexist laws that were still on the book while I was alive. A lot of people think the sexual revolution and the and civil rights era ended in 1968, that everything before the death of Martin Luther King, that was where all the significant stuff happened. But there was still a lot of stuff to work through, and this is a great example of it. So that's just the justification for the story and the movie. The movie itself works. I mean, it's predictable. If you know the history, obviously, but also it's kind of telegraphed. You know how it's going to go. Even when they kind of draw things out, you know, and you're like, what's going to happen? You know, it's going to happen because it's not terribly well at hiding the movie's own intentions. But it works as a film, and great performances by Taraji P. Henson and her pendulous breasts. They're almost comical because, I mean, she's a young, fit woman, and they have to kind of make her a little, let's just say, saggier. And it's almost distracting at times. I don't know why I focused on that, but she does a great job in it. Sam Rockwell does a great job. I think a better acting performance is by Henson. But Rockwell does a good job as well. And the other reason that this is an important movie is it shows that there is a humanity to everybody. And people may have their prejudices, and their prejudices might be caustic and horrible and mean and criminal. But that doesn't mean that they're not a human being. And the second you start not seeing people, even if they're awful, horrible white supremacists, if you start seeing them as less than human, then you've lost the battle. You have to come together. It's about a peaceful resolution. And this movie's not fantastic, but it's worth seeing, and I think it's worth checking out. So I'm going to have to give it a kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the aftermath. In Hamburg, Germany in 1946, the British work to rebuild relations in the city while an officer's wife falls in love with the widower whose house they commandeer.
This house is being requisitioned by the British government.
My daughter and I will stay out of your way until we move to the camp.
What if we let them stay on?
You mean live with them?
There may not be an outward show of hatred, but it's there below the surface.
During the war, did you ever hope for a German victory? Did the bombing affect the health of you and your family?
It affected the health of my wife.
She died in the firestorm.
I'm so sorry.
Oh, let me just start off by saying it's a beautiful looking movie. It's gorgeous. The cinematography is amazing. It takes place in the wintertime and it's snowy and it's got this stark look to it, but it's beautiful at the same time. And of course, they live in this really nice house that's very opulent and decorated. And I mean, it's an incredibly beautiful looking movie. Okay, I've said that. Let's set that aside. Into the story, it's after the war's over. But there's still tensions there. I mean, you're gonna carry a grudge if somebody bombs your home and your family dies or people you know die or your business is completely destroyed and left in rubble. You're gonna be kind of cheesed off about that. And so there was bad blood. And I think what's so fascinating about this movie is in this day and age, the bad blood is easy to see on the surface. You know, the biggest attack that America's suffered in recent years was 9/11. That was done by Islamic terrorists. So they're easier to identify as opposed to the difference between a British person and a German person. You're just looking at language almost at that point. In this day and age, it's very easy to take it on a quite literal face value. But this shows that back then where people were essentially very similar in blood and they were much closer in terms of race, but they hated each other because of nationality and where they lived. And it shows the animosity and the danger and how those bridges have to be built up again. I found that fascinating. I after any sort of violence that happens, and also where your loyalties lie in the insurgencies, because you still have, you know, it's 1946, so there are still people who are loyal to Hitler. When the war was over, does not mean the violence ends. And we've seen that happen out in the Middle East. Just because the war is technically over in Iraq doesn't mean that it's not a dangerous place to be. So that's all fascinating. And then the movie turns into a love triangle, and it's about Keira Knightley falling in love with the widower because his wife was killed and her son was killed in the bombing in London. And then it completely deflates halfway through the movie. And part of that is because that whole story is, it's all about her, and she's kind of I don't care about the character, and I don't find her interesting, and I find her kind of a snot, and it becomes extremely predictable, and all that interest that was in the beginning of it is squandered at the end of the film. So I'm going to have to say that I wasn't a huge fan of the aftermath because of the turn it takes in the middle. And so for that reason, I'm going to give it a kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Shazam and Pet Sematary.
Let the midnight special shine a light on me.
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about Shazam! Teenage foster child Billy Batson is given superpowers by a mysterious wizard and must use them to stop an evil madman.
Billy Batson, I choose you as champion. Say my name so my powers may flow through you.
But I don't know your name, sir.
Shazam.
Shazam?
Ah, ah! It's me, it's Billy!
What is happening?
You're the only person I know that knows anything about this Caped Crusader stuff.
What are your superpowers?
Superpowers, dude? I don't even know how to pee in this thing.
First of all, I have to acknowledge that I understand the whole history of Shazam. Originally, the character was Captain Marvel. It was created in the 40s, published by Fawcett Comics. And the name Shazam was the name of the wizard, and that's the word that gave him the powers, which makes it difficult to be called Shazam. So what's your name? Shazam. Oh, crap, I turned back into Billy Batson. So that's why he had a different name. Well, eventually DC sued Fawcett Comics and said the character's too similar to Superman, and Fawcett had to stop publication, I think, in the 50s. Well, in the 60s, Marvel Comics created their own version of Captain Marvel, which was a Kree story, and that's what we see in the theaters now with Brie Larson, although she's like sort of like not, she's not the original Captain Marvel in there. There have been multiple Captain Marvels in the Marvel universe. But then Marvel owned the name Captain Marvel, and DC ended up purchasing the rights to Shazam and that original Captain Marvel and brought the character back in the Shazam comic in, I think, the 70s. Eventually, I don't know, about 5 or 10 years ago, they just dropped the name Captain Marvel altogether because it's too confusing, and they knew that there was a development of a Captain Marvel movie, so they just call him Shazam. I have read Shazam comics ever since I was a kid because it's one of my dad's favorite superheroes. So I remember reading them when I was much, much younger. So I'm really well versed in at least certainly the early years of Shazam, or that version of Captain Marvel. And I was real nervous when they made this movie because I was like, I don't know what they've done in that. I don't know what they've changed in this character 70 years later. And let's go check this out. And I gotta say, I went to go see this movie and I thought it was a lot of fun. Part of the thing that I liked about this is it's in DC, and DC has finally shed that cloak of everything needs to be dark and creepy. And what's funny is I got in a fight with this guy online. He's actually a well-known movie journalist. Because I blamed Christopher Nolan for stuff like Man of Steel and the overly dark characters that they made Superman. And he's like, Christopher Nolan had nothing to do with that. I'm like, no, he absolutely did, because his production company started it. Jonathan Nolan helped write the script for Man of Steel. And it was being billed at the time when they're developing Man of Steel as Christopher Nolan type take on Man of Steel. But he just wanted to blame Zack Snyder. It's not only Zack Snyder's fault. Zack Snyder was just following the direction he was given by the studio and his production partner, which was Chris Nolan's company, Syncope. So this is partly Christopher Nolan's fault. You know, Batman versus Superman, Man of Steel, that overly dark turn in Justice League, that's partly Christopher Nolan's fault. What has happened over the last couple of years is Wonder Woman came out and they're like, wow, this is an inspirational, uplifting, fun movie and brightly colored. Let's not have it be dark and creepy. And it did incredibly well. And then they had Aquaman at the end of last year, and that thing's vibrant and colorful and totally different than the Batman versus Superman in a fun movie. And that did extremely well. And so now they're doing Shazam. And this is a fun, family-friendly, exciting, uplifting superhero movie. And that's what makes this movie work. Because going back to the original Shazam comics, back when he was even called Captain Marvel, back in the Fawcett Comics days, there were some goofy, silly things in there. They one of the characters, and not in the movie, don't worry, but it's a character from the comic books of this talking tiger. He walked around in a suit and a tie and a fedora, and he was like a professor, or he was an archaeologist or something at a museum. This is the kind of stuff they do. And even in this movie, they have the bad guy, Savannah, who is different than the character from the comics. The character from the comics was this sort of creepy, bald, nerdy scientist. And they got Mark Strong playing him, so he's a little bit more of a formidable guy. So they've changed that character up a bit. And that's consistent, I think, with the comics. But, you know, at the end of the movie, of course, every superhero movie, they're either teasing a new villain or what's coming up next or a new character. And the character they chose, I was like, wow, that is a bold choice. And it's a great character from the Shazam stories. And I give them a lot of credit because they chose one that's really kind of out of the box. They didn't go for the safe one, and good for them. This movie is just fun, and it has a real focus on the family and a good inspirational message and a message of unity and friendship. And it's something you take your kids to, and you don't have to worry that you're having Superman rip somebody's head off, quite literally. So this is a neat film, and I loved it. I thought it was a lot of fun. So if you have any reservations on it being overly dark, it's not there. It's the way a superhero movie can be. Not all movies have to be The Dark Knight. So I'm going to have to say Shazam totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Pet Sematary. This remake of Stephen King's disturbing novel sees a family move into a new house, which is near a burial ground that allows things to come back to life.
Maybe just some crazy folk tale,
But there is something up in those woods. Something that brings things back. Sometimes dead is better.
I read this book over 30 years ago. I was in high school, I think, maybe junior high, and I thought it was fascinating. Now, reading it as a teenager, I'm almost curious to go back and read it again, mainly because I'm a parent now. And if you know how what happens in Pet Sematary, you're going to come at this with a very different perspective as a parent. Especially if you've had anyone who's taking care of young children. Because there's some disturbing stuff in this movie, because it gets dark. And this was the story that Tabitha King saved from the trash pile, because Stephen King stopped writing it because it bothered him too much to write it. And she found it and she read it and she's like, you got to keep writing this. This is good. Mary Lambert's version was not well received when it came out in 1989, but it's got a lot of love for it now. There's a lot of respect for the movie. And part of what I liked about that movie is it started out as this quaint, idyllic house, and it's beautiful, and it's kind of this sweet little family movie. And then it starts, weird things start happening, and then soon it really takes this turn to be dark. My problem first with this movie, this new one, is it's dark and creepy from the beginning. All the wallpaper is dark. There's no lights on in this house. It's dreary and grim, and the kids burying their pets in the regular pet cemetery. They're walking around with masks on. I mean, it looks like they're right out of the Wicker Man. So, I mean, it starts off and hits the ground running as a creepy little film. And it's sort of like the complaint that Stephen King had with The Shining when Stanley Kubrick made that movie. He's like, you know, Jack Torrance, played by Jack Nicholson, is bonkers from the first time he opens his mouth. With The Shining, the book, it's a slow descent into madness for Jack Torrance. And I feel that's the same way about this Pet Sematary, so that when the really creepy, insane stuff starts happening in the middle or end of the movie, you're sort of tired of it. You're kind of, oh, okay, and more dark, creepy, weird stuff. And they play their hand a little bit too much. They have all the stuff with the wife, Rachel, and her sister Zelda, and the memories of that, and I just felt it was more effective in the original movie. It's sort of like if you took the original movie and you buried that movie in the Pet Sematary, and this is what case come back. It's still effective and creepy, but it's changed. And famously, they did change a major plot point at the end for the third act. Now, if you've seen the second trailer, you know what that is. This changes the film. It changes what can happen, and it actually makes it less disturbing. It opens the door for some exploration into something, but they never fully explore that. And that's unfortunate, because that's the only reason to do what they did. And I don't know, that last act could have been done better, and I think they went for more sensationalism as opposed to just the grisly realities of what's going on in the original version. Also, I love John Lithgow. I think he's a national treasure. Still can't hold a candle to Fred Gwynne with a "sometimes dead is better." So yeah, Mary Lambert still made the superior version of this film. But if you like Stephen King and you want something creepy, it works. I'm going to give it a kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the first episode of the Twilight Zone revival, the box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring Mortal Engines. And welcome back to the final segment of Fat Guys at the Movies for the week. And I'm going to leave you off with a review of, I don't do TV all that often, but sometimes I do. So let's talk about the new Twilight Zone, the reboot that has come out from CBS All Access. Jordan Peele hosts this reboot of the classic anthology series featuring fantasy, science fiction, and horror stories.
Everything you said would come true has.
I changed something. Erased something.
We're not meant to be here.
Life sometimes goes like you don't expect it to.
What did you do to me?
Turn it off.
This is real.
I don't actually have a CBS All Access account, but I might get it for this because I'm curious about the rest of the Twilight Zone movies. What's nice, and if you're curious about watching this, CBS All Access has put the very first episode on YouTube. So you can watch it for free. And if you really want to watch the second episode, or if you want to wait till they're all out there, I think you get like a 1 or 2 week free trial, and you can just binge watch all of it and then cancel the account. And it's like $5.99 month to month, so you don't have to pay. It's not like Amazon where you got to pay for the whole year. Now, in this first episode, it's called The Comedian, and it stars Kumail Nanjiani. And most people will recognize him. He had done the movie The Big Sick. He wrote and starred in that movie, and that's actually a real-life story of him and his wife, how he got to know her and how she had an issue and how he ended up getting to know her family as well. He plays a comedian who does mostly politics, and he usually doesn't get laughs for it. And he's advised by another famous comedian to do the stuff in his own personal life. And when he starts doing it, when he tells jokes about someone or something, like his dog, when he's done telling the joke, it no longer exists. And this is a very Twilight Zone-y kind of story. It's exactly the kind of thing that Rod Serling would have put together when he was around. It's one of those things that's stranger than life, and it's a bit of a cliche type idea. In a way, this is similar to Stephen King's The Word Processors of the Gods, the story that I think has been adapted in a couple ways for short films, where you could type something into a word processor and hit delete. Of course, we don't have word processors really anymore. We all have computers. But this was written back in the 80s when word processors were a thing. So it's an interesting idea. And then what it does is it shows what decisions he makes, how to get rid of people and who to get rid of. And he's given this power and what can happen with that power. It's effectively done. It absolutely is. What's interesting is Jordan Peele's attached to it. I don't know how much involvement he's having on it from an episode to episode basis, but he's the host. He's the Rod Serling character, the introduction and the ending, you know, the framework, the bookends of the series. He's okay in it. It's just, there's such an adjustment to make with Jordan Peele because he's so known for comedy. And I think we've all accepted the fact that he can direct horror movies because he did Get Out and Us. But still, when you see Jordan Peele, you don't immediately think, that's creepy. You look at him and you'd be like, oh, is he going to do his Barack Obama impression? So, I mean, he spent so long on Key and Peele with these iconic roles that he would play, and they were all goofy and silly, that seeing him on screen isn't as intense. But I fully respect the guy for going to do something different that is really making him stand out, and it's bolstering his directorial career as a writer and director in future films. The episode of The Comedian's okay. It's a middling episode of The Twilight Zone. I don't know if it's the strongest one to start with. I think it opens up some ideas, and I think it shows that they're contemplating something more than just creepy stories, because the Twilight Zone always was about what would you do and how does this affect the world, and it always was replete with social issues and ideas and messages. So I think this one has that. The one thing that does concern me, though, is it's an hour-long show. And I always grew up knowing that the best episodes that I remember were the half hour episodes. There was a season, I think it was season 4, that they went to hour long episodes. And to be honest, I don't remember any of those. I don't remember those as being the best ones. The best ones were those half hour, somewhat breezy, intense episodes. And, you know, putting 44 minutes into a story, sometimes you'd have to pad. And I'm hoping that they don't have to do that too much in this series. But it's a good start. I may actually even, fork over $6 a month to check out the rest of these. Who knows? I might just at least do the free trial and check out the next one. But I'm going to have to say that the Twilight Zone so far kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office really quick. Last week, Dumbo won, but it came in under its expectations. So it's sort of like a bittersweet win. Yes, it was number one. I think it was the second highest grossing movie that Tim Burton had directed for its opening weekend. The first one, of course, being Alice in Wonderland, which was a juggernaut. But it made about $46 million, which is really, really good. And Us came in second with 33. I mean, Us is over $130 million coming out of the weekend. Unplanned did a little bit better. It was still like a low end number. It was under 10 million, but it was like 6.5. And then The Beach Bum came in at a dead 10 with just under $1.8 million. It's the lowest opening of a major release in Matthew McConaughey's history. I'll be curious to see what happens with Dumbo. I think the soft initial box office number, I think it's not going to have the legs. I think there's a lot of strong stuff in competition coming up in the next couple weeks. But where you're going to see it win is in the international box office. Tim Burton movies tend to do better in the international box office. And I think that's what's going to save this movie, which is what saved some of his other films as well. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. The movie I want to spotlight today is Mortal Engines. I think the Blu-ray and DVD came out last week, if I'm not mistaken. But I wanted to give this one another shot. I watched it in December at Christmas time, and I was not a fan. I ended up dozing off in the movie. It was kind of a heavy film, and it just kept going and going and going. So I wanted to give it another chance. So I checked it out on Blu-ray. In an apocalyptic future, cities run on wheels across the wasteland, and a young woman tries to stop the leader of London, who plans to destroy millions of people.
60 minutes is all it took to bring humanity to the very brink of extinction. Mankind mobilized. A new age arose. The age... the great predator cities.
I've been looking for you for a long time. Your mother, she said she had found something dangerous. She was afraid of Valentine, of what he might do.
A man who controls this, controls the world.
She said that you could stop him.
I was not as annoyed with this movie. I got annoyed in the theater thinking the writing wasn't very good. And it felt one of those, I mean, it was based on a young adult book, and it felt like they crammed a lot of stuff in the book that enriches the book, and then they tried to cram all that same detail into the movie, and by doing that, it just becomes absurd. And Maze Runner did this, where he comes in, I remember there's a scene in the Maze Runner where he first shows up in the maze, and the guy's like, well, these people are called that, and that person's called that, and this is the thing, and this is the wall, but we call it the whatever, and this is the monsters in the wall, but we call them whatever, and there's this, and there's this. And I remember watching the Maze Runner going, they got a name for everything. Just call it a maze, you know? And I felt the same way about the Mortal Engines, is they had a name for everything and a reference for everything. And it was something that I think was preserved from the book, but just became cumbersome in the film. Now, it's a gorgeous looking movie. The production design is fantastic. And it also has a lot of virtual sets. And I remember when they started doing virtual sets about 20 years ago with movies like Sky Captain and The World of Tomorrow. And of course, they had the original Sin City, which was fantastic. And then I remember the TV show V, and they used virtual sets on those. And that was before digital technology got as complex and as detailed as they have now. There's a lot of virtual sets on this, and I could tell because part of it is, well, they're absurdly huge sets that would be cost prohibitive to build. But there's also a lensing issue and in terms of perspective. But I thought the virtual sets looked really cool. And I love the steampunk look. But this is sort of like Mad Max on steroids, where entire cities are going after each other. And as cool as that is, it does get a little unbelievable at times, even for its crazy post-apocalyptic movie. Also, the characters... everyone's got a connection to somebody else, and they got these characters who are overly stylized, and then there's this bounty hunter who's coming after her for the dumbest reason you've ever heard of. The characters do things that are overkill and over-the-top gestures that don't really make sense pragmatically. I could see where this worked as a young adult book, but as a movie, I think it's lacking something. And maybe part of it is it also doesn't have a Jennifer Lawrence or a Shailene Woodley to be the lead character. The girl who is in the movie, I don't think she's terrible, but there's no equity in her name and there's no fan base for her that would drive people to the theaters. Whereas you had that with Jennifer Lawrence, you had that with Shailene Woodley. Both of them came with something to go with it and then propel their career forward. So I still feel it's not a great movie, but I have to say I did enjoy it better the second time. So I'm going to have to say Mortal Engines, I'm going to be nice now and give it a very slight, very, very slight Kind of Rocks.
It Kind of Rocks.
Other movies this week include Bumblebee, Vice, and The Mule, all out on DVD and Blu-ray. And that is it. I need to go. So next week I'm going to be talking about Hellboy, Little, and The Missing Link. And until then, have a fat time at the movies.